This is Blacklisted Talk Radio. I'm King David McKenzie. It's now 12:27 on the 2nd of December, 2011, on killradio.org from Los Angeles, California. And now to the old-time radio section of today's program. And I have a couple of very interesting little bits here. Back on Halloween weekend, I played a program that was centered around the Orson Welles' War of the Worlds broadcast from October the 30th of 1938. And going back in time, it's rather interesting that there was an incident in of all places, San Antonio, Texas, where Orson Welles, by then the actor, movie star, great radio and stage personality, had the chance to actually meet up with H.G. Wells, the author who had written the War of the Worlds novella. I believe the station was the station actually has been known. I think it's mentioned in the clip. The call letters at the time, at various times at different times it was known as either KSAT for San Antonio, Texas, or KTSA for Texas San Antonio. I think the announcer is going to mention exactly which call sign was accurate for the time that this incident occurred. But here is a recording, and as I understand it, this is only an edited recording of Orson Welles meeting H.G. Wells in San Antonio, Texas, and I believe this is perhaps the spring of 1941. I'll check on that again in a few moments. It's either 1940 or 1941, that I definitely know. And here, and by the way, I think it was KSAT or KTSA that had broadcast the War of the Worlds broadcast in 1938. I'll check on that as well. In any event, here's H.G. Wells meeting Orson Welles in San Antonio, Texas.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Charles C. Shaw speaking. KTSA is honored this evening by the presence in our studios of two great men, the Honorable H.G. Wells, world-famous British historian, author, and student of world affairs, and Mr. Orson Welles, the genius of stage, screen, and radio. This is the first time that Mr. H.G. Wells and Mr. Orson Welles have appeared together. In fact, they met for the first time only yesterday here in San Antonio. But this is not the first time that their names have been linked. 2 years ago, Mr. Orson Welles adapted Mr. H.G. Wells' book, War of the Worlds, for radio purposes, and you know the rest. Revising the story somewhat, Mr. Orson Welles depicted an invasion of the United States by men from Mars. Although he explained at numerous times during the program that it was fictitious, the country at large was frightened almost out of its wits. Men called radio stations offering to enlist against the Martians. Others were panic-stricken. The realism of the production, frightening though it was a tribute to Mr. Orson Welles' genius. And thus the name of Welles, H.G.W.E.L.L.S. and Orson W.E.L.L.E.S. became linked. Mr. H.G. Wells, in the opinion of many, is the world's most famous man of letters. He has come to San Antonio to address the United States Brewers Association and Mr. Orson Welles is here for a town hall forum address Wednesday. In this meeting of great minds, I feel rather inconspicuous, and the less I have to say, the better you listeners will like it. But first, could I interest you gentlemen in a discussion of Mr. Orson Welles' broadcast of Mr. H.G. Wells' book, The War of the Worlds?
Are you turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over to us. Well, I've had a series of the most delightful experiences since I came to America. But the best thing that has happened so far is meeting my little namesake here, Orson. I find him the most delightful carrier. He carries my name and an extra E that I hope he'll drop sooner or later. I see no sense in it. And I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
I think that's the nicest thing that a man from England could possibly say about the men from Mars. Because Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, and actually spoke of it in the Great Munich speech, you know. Mm. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
There's not much else to say.
And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did. I think it's very nice of Mr. Wells to say that not only I didn't mean it, but the American people didn't mean it.
That was our impression, England. We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts?
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't you?
What kind of excitement? Mr. H.G. Wells wants to know if the excitement wasn't the same kind of excitement that we extract from a practical joke in which somebody puts a sheet over his head and says, boo, I don't think anybody believes that that individual is a ghost, but we do scream and yell and rush down the hall. Mm-hmm. And that's just about what happened.
That's a very excellent description.
You aren't quite serious in America yet. You haven't got the war right under your chins, and the consequence is you can still play with ideas of terror and conflict.
You think that's good or bad?
It's a natural thing to do until you're right up against it.
So it ceases to be a game.
And then it ceases to be a game.
Well, now, here's a thought. Some of Mr. H.G. Wells' writings are termed fantastic, and a few years ago, well might they have been conceived such. The shape of things to come, which told of a long internecine war, was such a fantasy. But, Mr. Orson Welles, do you think that it's so fantastic in view of today's events?
It certainly is not so fantastic, and the one question that Mr. Wells has spoken of, not only in the shape of things to come, but has hinted at or directly prophesied such a state of affairs following a wasting war and a return to a feudalism from which the world would find itself again. And today in Mr. Wells's lecture, he said quite the most interesting thing that I've heard in a long time. He said that he'd commenced just recently to ask himself if there was any reason why mankind should so emulate the phoenix and should so get itself out of its mess. He proposed a couple of solutions, but he did admit that there was a possible excuse for a gloomy point of view. Mm-hmm. And that it would be good to be realistic about it and not to dismiss the gloomy point of view anymore. Perhaps the time had come to look ahead, since the future, Mr. Wells's future, which we've always adored and never really understood, is suddenly upon us.
Mm-hmm.
And we are living right now in that famous H.G. Wells future, which we all knew about.
Now, before we get away from this microphone, tell me about this film of yours that you've been producing. You're a producer, aren't you? You're
that's right.
Art director, you're everything.
Well, Mr. Wells,
what's the film called?
It's called Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yes. Not C-A-I-N.
No, K-A-N-E, and this is, of course, the kindest and most gracious possible thing to do. Mr. Wells is making it possible for me to do what in America is spoken of as a plug. And he understands this fine old American
custom. I don't understand these words, yes.
Yes. You understand the value, however. Mr. Wells wants me to tell you that I have made a motion picture, and he is kind enough to ask me a leading question concerning it.
I'm looking forward to it.
You're very kind, sir. It's a new sort of motion picture with a new method of presentation and a few new technical experiments, a few new methods of telling a picture, not only from the point of view of writing, but of showing it.
If I don't misunderstand you completely, I think there'll be a lot of jolly good new noises in it.
I hope so. I think a few jolly good new noises are what the motion pictures could well afford these days. I hope you're right, and I hope there are some jolly good new noises. I think of nothing more desirable in motion picture. I'm all for some jolly good new noises.
Orson Welles meeting H.G. Wells. The date on that was October the 28th, 1940. So actually just a couple of days short of 2 years after the CBS network and KTSA in San Antonio, being one of the CBS affiliates, broadcast the Orson Welles adaptation of the H.G. Wells novella, The War of the Worlds. Very fascinating. So this is a pre-war. Well, actually not pre-war, because the reason for H.G. Wells being in America was more or less to try drum up some support for the British war effort against Hitler. So this was prior to the United States becoming an active belligerent in the Second World War, and we'll be hearing some information about that in about an hour or so. First, though, before anything else, we do have a couple of half-hour dramas from that period. One is going to be Orson Welles on the night of December 7, 1941. Almost 70 years ago. It'll be 70 years ago next week. In a Norman Corwin script that Corwin didn't particularly like all that much. And we'll be getting into that in a few minutes. However, before that, from from March the 9th of 1940, an adaptation as the fire department and apparently the rescue squad are coming over to nearby the studio here. I'm sure that you're able to hear the sirens in the background. From March the 9th of 1940, it was in either in 38 or 39 that Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo was published to great critical and commercial success, one of the classic anti-war novels of the 20th century. And on the 9th of March of 1940, an adaptation of it was broadcast throughout the country with James Cagney playing Joe Bonham, the main character in the novel. And another great radio playwright by the name of Arch Obler was the man who did the adaptation of the novel to the half-hour radio format. And this is one of the greatest radio broadcasts of the Golden Age. From the series Arch Obler's Plays, even though it's, of course, from the Dalton Trumbo source material, starring James Cagney, Johnny Got His Gun.
This is Arch Obler. For a little while, let me take you back to yesterday. Now, some say that yesterday is to be forgotten. I don't think so, and I don't think you think so, because in the memory of yesterday, in the pain and the laughter and the wonder, in the struggle, fulfillment, and the failure, sometimes is the clue for a better tomorrow. The early months of 1940, the earth was green with young spring, but in our world of men, the propaganda machines were shouting war, no war, fight, kill, peace on earth, no peace. And I read a book by sensitive young Dalton Trumbo, and my heart wept, and I wrote a play. And Jimmy Cagney looked in his own heart and was the man in that play.
Arch Obler's Plays. A Story in the Night. Tonight, James Cagney in Arch Obler's dramatization of the most talked-of book of the year, Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo.
Tell you of Joe Bonham. 22 years ago, he went to war. They carried him back from that war. They carried him back because he had no arms, no legs, no ears with which to hear, no eyes with which to see, no mouth with which to speak. Today, he lies alone in a room in a hospital close to your city. He's living flesh, and he waits. Your world is shut off from Joe Bonham. He has only the world within his own mind. We tell you of Joe Bonham. These are the thoughts of a boy who 22 years ago went to war.
Somebody listen to me. I'm talking to you. Somebody listen to me. Gotta talk to somebody. It's dark and lonely. Somebody... No. It's going out of my head again. How can you hear what ain't got a tongue, ain't got a mouth, ain't got... No, won't think of that anymore. Gotta think of something, yeah, something else. If I don't think, my head, yeah, quick, think about when I was a kid.
Hey, Joe, come on in swimming.
Yeah, swimming. When I was a kid, I went swimming. Dive in the river, feel the water against my legs and my arms. Now I haven't got any No, won't think of that. Think about... My town.
It's the nicest little old place on earth, Shale City.
I gotta remember.
Hamburger, get your hot hamburger. Get your hot hamburger.
Yeah, best hamburgers in the world.
All right, boy, here's 30 cents. Go down and get three hamburgers.
Pa.
Oh, they're delicious. If I could only cook like this.
Ma, she... No. No, don't think of her. Think about... County Fair.
See the lady cut in half the fourth part of a dollar.
A motorcycle rider, defying death inside a straight up and down circular wall.
I can't remember anymore. I gotta remember. If I don't remember things, I'll think, and if I think... No. I gotta remember something. Something. Girls. Think about girls. Quick, think about girls.
Joe.
Kareen?
Joe, I'm scared. I'm so scared.
No.
Kiss me. Hold me.
We shouldn't have turned the lights out. Your old man will be sore.
He understands.
Your lips.
Don't go. They'll kill you.
I gotta go. When you're drafted, you gotta.
Oh, Joe. Joe, I don't want you to go. Hold me. Tight. Maybe we'll never get another chance. Now, Joe. In your arms, Joe. In your arms. In your arms.
My arms. My arms.
What? What?
Joe, hold me. Don't go,
Johnny,
don't.
Get your gun.
Joe, I'm part of you now.
That's
don't go, Joe.
All aboard, soldier. All aboard, soldier.
No, no. Hold me, Joe. Hold me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms.
Now, no, stop. My arms. I haven't got any arms. You hear me, Kareen? I haven't got any arms. What's the matter with me? I didn't find it out yesterday or the day before. It was
1939, 1938, 1937.
A long time ago.
Joe.
Kareen, still in my head. I'll tell you as if you were here. Here's how I found out everything about myself. I woke up like out of a dream. It was like I was in the water. I tried to swim, but I didn't have any arms. I started to kick my legs to float up in the air out of the bed. But I couldn't kick. I didn't have any legs. I threw my head back. I started to yell. I only started. But how can you yell when you haven't got them? I began to reach out, Kareen. The only way I could reach out. With the nerves of my skin. The hole in my face. Feel the skin creeping around the edge of it. It went. I was blind. What a lousy dream. Nobody could live like that. Just dream, and that's all. But it wasn't a dream. It wasn't a dream. Mother. Mother, where are you? Hurry, Mother. Hurry, and wake me up. I'm having a nightmare, Mother. Where are you? Mother, listen to me. I can't stand it. Mother, please, tell me it's not me. Not me. Not me. No, not me. Oh, please. That's the way I found out a long time ago. Who was I telling that to?
Joe.
Oh, Kareen. Still in my head. In my heart. Now I'll tell you about how I found out about time. About the days. Knowing about the days you're living through, that's important, see? But all I remembered was... died in the dugout and then... And that was all. A day in September 1918, and that's all. Time stopped then. Start time over again. But how could I catch hold of time when I was caught inside myself? Vibrations. I had it. When the nurse came into the room, the vibration of her footsteps running up through the floor, through the bed, through the springs of the bed, into me. All I had to do was count the seconds, then the minutes, then the hours between each visit she made, until I had 24 hours counted up in my head. And after that, I'd be able to figure the days out just by counting up her visits. One day, the minute the nurse left me, I began to count.
One, two, three,
second by second,
four,
second
five,
by second.
Six,
when
seven,
I counted 60,
eight,
that
nine,
meant a minute
ten,
as nearly as I was able to figure it. But I always lost count. I'd think of something else. Then I'd lose count again.
One, two, three, one, two.
Day after five, day after day, four, but I could never keep track. Five, I couldn't. Six, I couldn't. Five. And all the time, the days were running away from me. And then, one day it happened. The skin on the side of my neck, the half of a forehead above the mask. Lying there all the years gone by, I got to thinking that maybe there was some way I could use those pieces of skin. Skin free to the air. They were healthy. I got to thinking what a man did with his skin.
To feel with.
But that didn't seem enough.
To sweat with.
Yeah, sweat with. Hot and cold.
Sunrise and sunset.
Just like that. The idea came into my head just like that. All I had to do was to feel with my skin. When it changed from cool to warm on that little piece of skin, it'd be sunrise and the beginning of a day. I got to thinking about the nurse and how many visits she made me each day and when she made them. Yeah, I'd better start with the nurse. She changes the bedding. In a hospital, they must change bedding in the morning, maybe around 8 o'clock. So all I got to do is wait till she changes the bedclothes. That'll mean it's morning. Then wait, maybe 18, 20 hours, and that'll be next morning. That'll be sunrise. You can feel the heat of sunrise against your skin, yeah. So I waited until the next time she changed the bedding. She walked away. Calm down, because you haven't proved anything yet. Calm down and wait and count her visits. Number two, I dozed off and woke. Visit number three. Time got all mixed up. Then four, and then the fifth time. Now all of a sudden, I knew it was happening. My heart stopped. My breath stopped. I knew it was happening. Slow at first, crawling along my skin. Warmer and warmer. Rising sun. In my room. In my room. I'd won. I'd won. I'd caught up with time again. The sun. It was dawn. It was dawn for the world and for me. I could smell the dawn. Yeah, me without a face lying there. And the smell of the dew on the grass. And me without eyes shading my eyes and seeing the sun coming up over the mountains back home. And the hills going pink and lavender like the inside of a seashell. The sun warming my little piece of skin, and me seeing without eyes the town where I was born, and me without ears hearing the lowing of the cows waiting to be milked, and babies kicking in their cribs and rubbing their eyes with their fists. It's sunrise, and I've got it. And now I'll always know when it's sunrise, and they can't take it away from me. Thank you, God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I may never have anything else, but I'll always have dawn and the morning sunlight. A year went by fast. I was a busy guy. I learned a lot. Yeah, could even tell my nurses apart. The day nurse always walked to the bed with four steps. She was always the same, but the night nurses seemed to change. One of them must have cried when she looked at me. I felt her tears wet on me. I like to think she was young and beautiful. But every night, summer and winter, week in and week out, month in and month out, every night I was with you, Karim. With you, darling. My arms around you, yours around me. With you, Karim.
Joe, my darling.
Close to you.
My dearest.
My arms around you.
My lover.
And yours around me.
Mine.
With you, Karim.
Oh, Joe.
2 years went by after I discovered time. 3 years went by after I discovered time. The fourth year started awfully slow. One day I felt vibrations. Vibrations heavier and heavier, and then they stopped. I knew they were standing around the bed. After all these years, visitors. And all at once, crazy thoughts went through my head.
It may be your mother.
No.
Karim.
No, no, not Karim. Not Karim standing by my bed. You can't see me. Not this way. Not you, Karim. Go away.
Go away, go away, go away, go away, go away.
Then a hand came to rest on my forehead. A man's hand.
Doctors?
Yes. Maybe doctors come to examine me. Somebody was touching at my nightshade over my left breast. The cloth fell back against my chest again. It was heavy now, weighed down by something. Medal! They given me a medal. Me! A medal! Me! A medal! Me! The generals were here. Around my bed. The generals. The big guys. The famous guys who still had arms and legs and could still see and talk and smell and taste. In my throat, I felt a tearing of something that used to be a voice. I was talking to them, and they couldn't hear me. I was saying, listen, big guys, I'm lying here like a side of beef, and for what?
War. We're going to war.
Yeah, someone said that, so I went. But why? Why? Somebody just said,
let's go out and fight for liberty.
Liberty? What kind of liberty? How much liberty and whose idea of liberty? A guy says, come on, let's fight for liberty. And he can't show you liberty. If you're going to die for liberty, you've got to know in advance what liberty is and whose idea of liberty they're talking about and just how much of that liberty we're going to have. Maybe that's a bad way to think. The big guys say it's bad, and I heard them. In the schools and the newspapers and the legislatures and the congresses, that's their business. They sound wonderful.
This ground is sanctified by blood.
They shall not have died in vain.
Our noble dead.
But I'm asking you, big guys, what do the dead say? Did any one of them ever come back and say,
I'm glad I'm dead because death is always better than dishonor.
Did they say,
I'm glad I died to make the world safe for democracy.
Nobody but the dead know whether all these things people talk about are worth dying for or not. And the dead can't talk. So the words about noble death and sacred blood and honor and such are all put into dead lips by those that got no right to speak for the dead. I'm asking you, big guys, how did they feel about it just before they died? Did all those guys die thinking of democracy and freedom and liberty and honor? You know they didn't. They died crying in their minds like little kids. They died crying for the face of a friend. They died crying for the voice of a mother or father or wife or baby. They died moaning and crying for life. I know. I'm the nearest thing to a dead man on earth. There's nothing bigger than life. What's noble about having your legs and arms blown off? What's noble about being blind and deaf and dumb? I'm dead, big guys, and I died for nothing. You hear me? Nothing, nothing. You hear me, big guys? But they didn't hear me. Just as you couldn't hear me, Karim, if you were standing next to me. All the generals heard was the blowing of the air and the tube in my throat. When I heard the vibrations of the footsteps that said they were going, I began to think. The vibrations. Up to now, I thought only of the vibrations coming to me. How about making my vibrations go to them? Yes, vibrations to them. A footstep on the floor is a kind of vibration. The tap of a telegraph key is another kind. I had it. I had it. When I was a kid, Bill Harper and me, we had a telegraph set. Used to telegraph to each other. Dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dash, dot. I remember the code, the Morse code. All I had to do to break through to the people outside was to lie in bed and dot, dash to the nurse. I could give messages and receive messages. I raised my head from my pillow. I dropped it. Then I did it twice quickly. That was it. With my head, raised my head, let it fall on the pillow. The Morse code. S-O-S, help. I tapped it out of my pillow with my head. S-O-S, all over the world, that meant help. S-O-S, help, help. Then the door of the room jarred open and the nurse's footsteps came up to the bed. S-O-S, S-O-S, over and over again. She was looking at me. I knew it, I knew it. S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, oh, why can't you understand? S.O.S. Help me. S.O.S. Help me. S.O.S. S.O.S.
Help me. S.O.S. Help me.
My head full of it. Tapping it out with my head over and over. Over and over. Couldn't stop. Why won't they hear me? Why won't they understand? Why won't they hear me? Karen, why? No. There isn't any Karen. There isn't nothing. I've been talking in my head. There's nothing for me. Nothing.
S.O.S.
I don't know what day it is.
S.O.S.
I don't know what month it is.
S.O.S.
I don't know what year it is.
S.O.S.
I've been tapping for years and years and nobody hears
me.
S.O.S. Nobody, nobody, nobody. Someone's come into the room. Footstep light. My regular day nurse. Hers are heavy. Who's this one? Start tapping now. What? What does this one do? Opening the nightshirt. She's moving the tip of her finger against my skin. Huh? Drawing something. Huh? I know. The letter M. I know. Shake my head. Yes, yes, I know, I know. I understand. It's M, M, wonderful M. Writing something else on my skin. E. Yes, yes, I got that. R, yes. Another R, yes. Now what? Why? Nothing more. M-E-R-R-Y. Mary. Writing again. C-H-R-I-S-T-M-A-S. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, nurse, I understand. Nodding my head to tell you I understand. I can't say it so you can hear me, but in my heart I'm saying it. Merry Christmas, nurse. God bless you. Bells in my town. I'm hearing them in my head, nurse.
'Twas the night before Christmas.
Mother.
And all through the house. Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
Mother, I hear you.
The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in a hope that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
Every Christmas Eve, I remember.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew like down from a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Merry Christmas, Mother. Merry Christmas, Mother. Nurse. New nurse. Smart nurse. She'll pay attention to me. Old nurse didn't understand. New nurse, you've got to understand. Cabin, I'll start. There, nurse. I did it. Did you understand it? 3, 2, and 3. S-O-S. Did you understand it? I'll do it again. Morse code. You understand? Morse code. Watch, nurse. Watch. If I had a tongue, if I had a mouth, I'd yell it at you. I'd scream it at you. But I have nothing but the tapping of my head. So watch, nurse. Watch. If you turn and walk out of the room and never come back, you will be carrying my life with you. You're life and death to me, nurse. Look, I'll tap it again. See? S-O-S. Help me. S-O-S. Oh, I'll do it again. I'm praying now, nurse. Me, just an ordinary guy, I'm praying. Oh, please, God, make her understand what I'm trying to tell her. Please, God, make her understand. I know you're a busy guy. I know there are millions of people praying to you every minute. I know all these things, God, and I don't blame you for getting behind in your orders. Nobody's perfect, but what I want is such a little thing. All I want you to do is to take a tiny little idea that's in my mind and put it in her mind 2, maybe 3 feet away. That's all I want, God. Just a little idea that's in my mind and put it in her mind. It's such a little thing, God. Such a little thing. She's gone away. She's gone out of the room. No, no, can't be true. Can't shove me down under the ground again, bury me deep again. No, no, I won't believe it, I won't. I won't start crying now. She'll come back. She's my life. She's my chance at life. She will come back. She will, she will, she will. Door. She's back. Brought someone with her. Man's finger on my head. What? Finger tapping on my head. Tapping out W. H, tapping out the code on my head. A, T, W, H, A, T, what? D, O, Y, O, U, Y, O, U, U. W, A, N, T. W, A, N, T. What do you want? What do I want? What do I want? What do I want? I want to get out. Let me out, that's all I want. I've been lying here for years and years in a room in a bed with a little covering of skin. Now I want out. I've got to get out. If I had legs, I could run away. I could get away. I could get out into the open where there's air, where there's room, where I'm not in a hole and smothering. Inside me, I scream and howl and push and fight for room and air for escape from the smothering, from the loneliness. Let me out of here. And take me back into the world. No. I didn't tap that out. What I just said, I only was thinking. Won't say it to you waiting up there, no. Before I ask you up there, before I tap it out with my head, I've got to think out just what I'm going to tell you. It may be my last chance. I've got it. I've got it. Listen, you up there. I'm tapping it out with my head. Let me out of here. Let me out of here. Let me out. I can earn my keep. I can do a job like anyone else. Take me out of here and build a glass case for me so people can see me. Take me in my glass case to the beaches, to the county fairs and the church bazaars and the circuses and the traveling carnivals. You'll do a wonderful business with me, and I could pay you for the trouble. They've never seen nothing like me. I'm something you can really holler about. I'm the dead man who's alive. The live man who's dead. I'm the man who made the world safe for democracy. Take me into the places where men work and make things. Take me there and say, boys, here's a cheap way to get by. Maybe times are bad and your salaries are low. Don't worry, boys, because you'll have your chance. There'll be another war along pretty soon, and then maybe you'll be lucky like me. Take me into the schoolhouses, all the schoolhouses in the world. They'll scream at first and have nightmares at night, but they'll get used to it because they've got to get used to it. And it's best to start them young. Take me into the colleges and universities and academies and convents. Call the girls together, all the healthy, beautiful young girls. Point to me and say, girls, here is your father. Look, girls, here is your lover. Call all the young men together and say, here is your brother, here is your best friend, and here are you, young men. Take me wherever there are parliaments and diets and congresses and chambers of statesmen. I want to be there when they talk about honor and justice and making the world safe. Put my glass case upon the speaker's desk, and every time the gavel drops, let me feel its vibration through my little glass case. Then let them draft notes and ultimatums and protests and accusations. But before they vote on them, before they give the order for all the little guys to start killing each other, let the main guy wrap his gavel on my case and point down at me and say, gentlemen, here is the only issue before this house, and that is, are you for this thing here, or are you against it? And if they are against it, then let them stand up like men and vote. And if they are for it, let them be hanged and drawn and quartered and paraded through the streets and thrown out into the fields where no clean animal will touch them, and may no green thing ever grow where they rot. Take me into your churches, your great towering cathedrals, which have to be rebuilt every 50 years because they are destroyed by war. Carry me in my glass box down the aisles where kings and priests and brides and children at their confirmations have gone so many times before to kiss a splinter of wood from a true cross on which was nailed the body of a man who was lucky enough to die. Set me high on your altars and call on God to look down upon his murderous little children, his dearly beloved little children. Then bring in the fierce ones, the spawners of hate, the inventors of slogans. Bring them in and make them look at me, and then dare them. Dare them to break the peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have brought you James Cagney playing the leading role in Dalton Trumbo's memorable novel of the year, Johnny Got His Gun. The book was dramatized for radio by Arch Oboler. The musical score was written, conducted by Gordon Jenkins.
And yes, the same Gordon Jenkins who would later do arrangements for pop singers like Frank Sinatra, John Gary. I believe he did a few for Perry Como in the 1950s. And also had a handful of hits on his own in the 1950s. My personal favorite of Gordon Jenkins' work is the Frank Sinatra album No One Cares, with that gorgeous version of Here's That Rainy Day that more or less single-handedly revived that song from relative obscurity. That was recorded, 1959, 1960, roughly? I'm King David McKenzie, and you're listening to Blacklisted Talk Radio on KillRadio.org from Los Angeles, California. If you're listening live, it's 1:14 in the afternoon on the 2nd of December, 2011. And the next old-time radio piece, we go back to Orson Welles, and this is a script from a man by the name of Norman Corwin, who just passed away a handful of weeks ago. And this, among all of the significant broadcasts of Corwin material, this is one script that Corwin really didn't, he wasn't all that, he didn't particularly like, for whatever reason. I don't know. Gonna have to ask him. But in any event, this is from the Gulf Screen Guild Theater, from December 7, 1941. Yes, there are a few brief, relatively oblique references to the Second World War, to Pearl Harbor, in this broadcast. But primarily, it's an American populist script that the Gulf Screen Guild Theater had coincidentally previously scheduled for that very night. And it is one of my favorite pieces of material from Orson Welles. Between Americans.
Between Americans, starring Orson Welles. The Gulf Screen Guild Theater. The Gulf Oil Companies and your good Gulf dealer are proud to present a dramatic picture of this, our America. Here is your host, Roger Pryor, to tell you about it.
Good evening, everyone. We welcome you tonight to one of the most timely programs ever heard on the Gulf Screen Guild Theater. Our production of Norman Corwin's script, Between Americans, starring Orson Welles. Broadcast at any time, we believe this program would make every American's heart beat a little faster. Make him hold his head just a little higher. But since the tragic and foreboding news that came today, this program, Between Americans, now becomes an American odyssey. In just a moment, our story will begin. But first, here's Bud Heaston.
Right. And here's an easy way to change from a pessimist into an optimist. If you're wondering now how long you may have to keep your present car, and wondering, too, if it will last, if it will stay in good condition, just look on the bright side of the picture. Remember, when you give the wearing parts of your car good protection, that helps it stay young and act young a long, long time. So give your automobile the modern method of lubrication, Go-Flex registered lubrication. Here's why. First,
expert Go-Flex operator works from a master chart of your model car. Thus protects each wearing point in the chassis and body,
Second,
the GoFlex man uses not just one or two greases, but six special lubricants, especially developed by lubrication authority.
And third, here's proof of how good these lubricants are.
In recent tests by Gulf engineers, GoFlex chassis lubricant, for instance, stayed in the shackles 30% better and lubricated nearly 100% longer than the average of competitive products tested.
So get GoFlex registered lubrication, a much better than usual grease job at no extra cost. Remember, too, that your good Gulf dealer is also ready with splendid motor oils and gasolines, such as Gulf No-Nox gasoline, the extra-value gasoline that has been especially designed to stop harmful pounding and hammering inside your engine. Make it a habit to stop regularly at your neighborhood good Gulf dealers, your headquarters for making your car last longer.
And now, Oscar Bradley's music introduces Orson Welles, who will talk Between Americans.
Program is Between Americans. That's where the title comes in. We hope you like it, but you don't have to. At any rate, nobody's going to make you stick around and listen to it. That's one of the advantages of being an American. Now, tonight we're doing something quite foreign to the type of thing usually presented by the Gulfstream Guild Theater. Instead of telling a story about five or six people, we're telling a story about 100 million. This happens to include you, listener, whatever your name may be. As a matter of fact, names don't bother real Americans very much. Not when we've got states named after French kings and English queens are lifted right out of the Latin language like Montana, or out of the Spanish like Nevada, and towns. You know, if you were to hold a convention of all the people who live in foreign-sounding American towns, we could fill quite a sizable stadium. Among the delegates registering on the first day would be...
Me, I'm the delegate from London, Minnesota.
I'm in from Dublin, New Hampshire.
Flew in this morning from Cairo, Illinois.
Huh? Whose turn, me? I'm from Canton, Connecticut.
I'm from Paris, Texas.
I came all the way from Shanghai, West Virginia.
Walsall, Georgia.
I'm the delegate representing Moscow, Kentucky.
My town is Toronto, Kansas.
As for me, Lisbon, Maine.
Delegate from Madrid, Alabama reporting.
I'm from Stockholm, South Dakota.
Drove down this afternoon from Bombay, New York.
Hitchhiked here from Baghdad, Florida.
All right, delegates, now that you've registered, you may all be seated. Now, that's all the preliminaries there's going to be tonight. We're through with the introductions, the overture, and the official registration. So now we can get down to the text, which is, roughly speaking, this. Today, particularly, people are thinking about their country pretty hard. Some of them for the first time in their lives. People are wondering where we're headed. Men are being called on to get ready to defend America. A lot of them are thinking in terms of what is there to defend. Well, now, America means a lot of things to a lot of people. Most of them are solid patriots, only they don't know it. They don't have to wear a red and white and blue button in their lapels to prove it. They don't have to agree with or even listen to people like this.
My fellow citizens! In this great state of Flint and Plethora, we can fix it on Squirtle your taxes. Our great country is cribbly bolted up and can wackle Tablewick, and your land and I will arrive, herring done forever.
We got a good hunch most people prefer the quiet kind of speaker, like the fellow who got up on a platform in a Pennsylvania town one day and said,
"The world will little note nor long remember what we say here."
That was the Gettysburg Address he was referring to. As a matter of fact, he didn't get such good reviews the next morning. Take, for example, the write-up he got in the Harrisburg Patriot.
We pass over the silly remarks of the president. For the credit of the nation, we are willing that they shall no more be repeated and thought of.
If you think that's bad, listen to what the Chicago Times had to say.
The cheek of every American must tingle with shame as he reads the silly, flat, and dishwatery utterances of the man who has to be pointed out to intelligent foreigners as the President of the United States.
Of course, the rival paper in Chicago took the opposite point of view. Rival papers often do.
The remarks of President Lincoln will live among the annals of man.
That paper gave it 4 stars, and they were right. The Gettysburg Address did survive. But that business of calling a president a ham is really something to be proud of. I mean, the right to print a piece saying a president makes a sound like dishwater. Nobody dragged the editors off to jail, even if they were wrong. That's important. Comes under the heading of free press. As soon as anybody starts gagging the press, any press, watch out. Americans don't like that. And by the way, we got on earth to be calling ourselves Americans all the time when we're really only United Staters. We're a little selfish about that. It's America down there in Chile, too. All the way down the spine of the Andes. If any of you folks are hearing this down around Mexico or Honduras or Salvador or Argentina, or even if you're an Eskimo in the Arctic, we hope you'll overlook our calling ourselves Americans as though we were the only ones in the hemisphere. We do that just because it's so much easier to say than anything else, and also because it sounds so good. By the way, before we leave the subject, what about the original Americans? The Indians? There's a forgotten race for you. How about the Indian on the nickel and the buffalo who roamed the back of the great American jit? Seems a shame. No two ways about it. We have forgotten those 100% Americans who went down to quarantine to meet the Mayflower. We don't see them around in person very much these days. But their ghosts are still with us. Maybe the red men are forgotten. Maybe not. But between you and us, it's said that near Boonesboro, Kentucky, on certain nights in November, by the light of the waning moon, some very peculiar ghost meetings go on in the woods south of the river. Also in certain parts of the Alleghenies, between the hours of sundown and the coming of the morning mist. Yes. If you happen to be listening to this in a car, driving along Highway 99 in Wyoming, that man you passed walking down the road a few miles back wasn't a man at all. Seriously, they were brave people. The Indians fought a losing fight against great odds. Wanted nothing more than to keep their land and their way of life. Fighting the fight so many people of all races have had to fight since. The fight to keep free and independent. The fight to stop men from the outside who want to civilize somebody their way. You ever ask yourself what America means to you? Does it mean 1776? Columbia, the gem of the ocean? Big business? The Bill of Rights? Uncle Sam? Chances are it means none of these things. Chances are it means something very personal to each of you. Something close to your heart which you'd miss like the very blazes if you were stranded abroad. Might have nothing at all to do with quotes from Madison or acts of Congress. It might be just the feeling about the crisp autumns in New England and the smell of burning leaves. Might be the memory of the way they smooth off the infield between the games of a doubleheader. Might be a thing as small as your little finger. You ever been abroad and run out of American cigarettes?
Hey, speak English, mister?
No, senor. Solo hablo español.
Well, anyway, do you carry cigarettes?
Ah, cigarrillos. Sí, tenemos bastante aquí.
No, I just want cigarettes. Here, I'll take these. How much?
20 centavos.
Yeah, keep the change. Hey, got a light there, senor?
Sí, como no, senor. Un momento.
Hey, what is this? Soft, cold soup? Tastes like an old shoe. Here, you can smoke the rest of them. Oy.
There you are. America might mean a tight-packed cigarette, which tastes good. Might mean the way a hot dog man slaps mustard on a Frank. Might mean going with your wife to the movie on bank night. Or taking your girl to the annual barn dance and social at Tuckerman's Barn. Plenty of you listeners know what I'm talking about. You hear people speak of home defense? This is the home to be defended. This square dance down the glen a piece, an old man Tuckerman's barn. This is the America of all the couples dancing there tonight. That's what the nation means to Butch and Fred and Jenny and Elvira. And this is America to all the boys and girls from Malvern County and their folks at home waiting for them. What do you suppose America means to that auto repair man in the grease cake dungarees who works in the garage in the corner of Willow and Elm Street? It means, quite likely, crawling under the 1936 Buick and dragging an electric light bulb on a long extension after him.
Hey, Joe, hand me that wrench.
What wrench?
The wrench at your feet. I got to finish this apprentice job.
Why don't he sell that jalopy and get a new boat?
Hey, you want to talk us out of business? As long as he keeps his car, we get a repair job once in a while.
Yeah, guess you're right.
Sure. That's America to Pete and Joe. Piston job, transmission job, valve job, jack it up, change the tire. New fan belt, check the pump. On Saturday night, take the girl down to Joyland Dance Park. Means repairs to those boys and cans of oil and carburetor mixtures. And to Jack Prentice, who owns the Buick that Pete is fixing and who lives down on the beach near the Coast Guard station, America means the sound and the sight and the smell of high tide under the full moon. Occasionally the melancholy note of the bellboy drifting up when the wind's blowing in from the ship channel. Means the age-old sound of the sea. The same sound folks are hearing this very minute up around Penobscot Bay and Winthrop Beach and Chincoteague Inlet down by Calabogue Sound and on Boca Chica and then clean over to the other coast by Guadalupe, Carmel. Yes. Wind and wave and sand and rock and riptide and undertow. That's America to Jack Prentice and the hundreds of thousands of folks settled on the coastlines between Eastport and Key West, Point Isabel and Birch Bay. America is all things to all her people. Prairie to Nebraskans, coal to Scranton miners, cameras and raw celluloid to the picture boys in Hollywood, the stink of crude oil to the men who work the wells, relief checks to the unemployed, a mic and a stopwatch to a radio production man, a BMT express to Brooklyn office workers. Sure, that's the way it goes. Or isn't it? What does this country mean to you? It might mean anything. Anything at all. It might mean a course in highfalutin poetry at Harvard.
Today, gentlemen, we will consider the influence of Whitman on the development of poetry in America. And by 1870, after 12 years of incessant attack against squeamish over-refinements, Whitman really began to create an active distaste for literary effort.
Or else it might be an argument between two baseball fans as to which is the better team, the Yankees or the Red Sox.
Yeah, but look! The Yanks are a bunch of old men and cripples.
Yeah.
They won't last, I tell you, they won't last! Well, it gets good and hot around the middle of July.
Yeah.
Well, look, double hitters begin piling up.
What are you talking? Listen, DiMaggio's having the best season he ever had. He's an old man, huh? Keller hitting a dozen homers. I'd like to be a cripple like that. New home run record for the club. Won't last, huh? Who's the Red Sox got as good as DiMaggio? Name one guy. Name one.
Name two. Ted Williams.
Well, a good hitter. No getting away from that. What do you say? Better than DiMaggio?
Pitching.
Wait a minute. Do you say...
Or it could be a poker game in Charlie Ferreter's law office upstairs over the 5 and 10 cent store on a rainy afternoon. Or a meeting of the Kiwanis Club in the Mansion House on Thursday. Or the news store. Or a great symphony concert sent out over everybody there, playing the music of all the world's great composers, regardless of their race or nationality. For instance, something by a great German Jew named Mendelssohn. Something you couldn't play in certain countries on the other side. Now let's stop a minute and figure this out. Is it an accident that makes just being a citizen in this comparatively young country so attractive to so many people? To the world's greatest skater from Norway? To the world's greatest mathematician from Germany? To the world's greatest orchestra conductor from Italy? Is it an accident that 1,000,000,000 people all around the world would give everything they own to be in your shoes? A free citizen of this country, right this very minute? Is it the weather here? Let's ask some of the natives. You from New York, how's the weather out your way?
Oh, I like it all right, only the summers give me a pain, sticky and hot. And then we usually get a stretch of terrible overcast weather around April and November. Sometimes 10 days go by without the sun coming out once.
And you, miss, from Miami, Florida.
Oh, our climate's fine. Except you have to watch out for sunburn.
A gentleman from Kansas?
Well, summers get pretty hot. Winter's pretty cold. Tornadoes raise a ruckus every once in a while.
Los Angeles. Hugh.
Ah, wonderful climate. Magnificent.
Don't you ever get tired of all that sunshine?
No, sir. Not a bit.
Never rains?
Well, a little precipitation maybe, but no rain.
No earthquake?
No, just little ones. Are you interested in some real estate?
No, thanks. And you from San Francisco, how about it there?
Best climate in the world, top.
Lots of sunshine?
Lots.
Lots of fog?
Lots.
All right. Then it's not the weather which makes it so attractive. Is it maybe our wine, women, and song? Let's ask the experts. You there, expert on women.
American women are beautiful, certainly. But we've never produced any classic or historic beauty. We've no legendary figure to compare with Helen of Troy, or with any of the Greek or Roman Venuses, or with Egypt's Cleopatra. As far as fiction is concerned, we can offer nobody to stand up against Italy's Juliet, or Germany's Isolde, or France's Roxanne. Certainly not Scarlett O'Hara.
Certainly not.
No, indeed.
All right, that's fine. Thank you very much. Now, what about our wines? Is that what makes America so attractive from the outside looking in? How about it, wine expert?
American wines are excellent, but then, of course, meaning no offense, have you ever heard of French champagne, Burgundy, Libramé?
All right, thank you. Thank you. Can it be our song, Maestro?
America can well be proud of its composers and of its wealth of folk music. But the fact of the matter is that we have yet to produce a single world great symphony, whereas Finland has produced 7, Germany and Austria, 50, the Russians about 12, the French 2 or 3, England 2 or 3, Bohemia...
Not song, then. Neither wine, women, nor song. So what is it, then? Well, it's this. Come right down to it. It's the spectacle of nearly 150 million people trying to live up to the expectations of a handful of great men who lived and died 150 years ago. Men who were so fed up with the kind of government they'd been getting, they sat down and wrote a new constitution for themselves and their children. A democratic constitution that's been added to but never been topped before or since.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press.
Or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances.
No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
The right of trial by jury shall be preserved.
Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted.
Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Or on account of sex.
Those are pretty good sentiments to be kept alive and flourishing in the world today. Of course, there are other things that makes our union a good one to belong to. It's a beautiful country, even though it has a lot of incorrigible badlands and corrigible slums. Aren't many countries have as much in them to look at and wonder about as this one. This can be a rather fierce country, too. Ever see the way its mountains frown down sometimes? Know what they're frowning at? Some rumors they heard about petty intrigue, about political bosses and shysters and fakers and grafters and men who make a business of jipping the people. Ever see the way the sky suddenly gets black and the thunder roars and the lightning starts throwing itself around? Ever see a storm whipping it up across the Great Lakes? That's how the American winds feel about anybody who denies anybody else a fair trial or free speech or the right to assemble or the right to worship as one sees fit. Well, then, in the final analysis, there can be no analysis. Many great thinkers and poets have attempted it, but the country's too big for any one man. There's Walt Whitman and Carl Sandburg and Tom Wolfe, and they all felt the magnitude and magnificence of the nation that got put together piece by piece like a jigsaw puzzle. They felt it and wrote about it in unforgettable ways. But still, it's bigger than any of them, or any of us. Whitman hit it on the nose when he said it was bigger than the president and the cabinet and the District of Columbia. It's not Park Avenue, or Broadway, or 42nd Street, or the Loop, or the Golden Triangle. It's other things. Many, many, many other things.
Mill towns.
Steel towns.
Tobacco towns.
Mining towns.
Oil towns.
Cotton towns.
Farmhouses.
Railroad sidings.
Statues on the common.
Tourist houses on the edge of town along the state highway.
Swimming holes.
Gas stations.
Stores on Main Street.
Kettles of sorghum molasses.
Sunday papers.
Season tickets to concerts.
Auctioneers.
Night courts.
Radios. Parades. Toothpaste. Shaving cream. Dogs. Cats. Skyscrapers. Subways. Cornfields, offices, hotel rooms, airports, hospitals, factories...
Oh, we could go on for weeks with this, never come any closer to a working definition of America. But to any real understanding of its total meaning... Look, how can you add up all the red and yellow neon signs, the smell of all the eggs and bacon frying in the morning, the bargain specials, the lessons learned... The cows let in from pasture. The mileage clocked up on automobile speedometers. The rainfall and the snowfall and the wind drifts. It's much too big for you, or me, or any of us who happen to stand alone or in small groups. It's much too great for any person or any party. Too much love by all its people, loved in spite of and because of its faults and virtues and its past mistakes and future promises. America is not a map, a poem, an almanac, a mural, a building in the heart of Washington. It's a territory possessed by people, possessed by an ideal. Well, that's all, listeners. Just wanted to talk between Americans for a half hour of a Sunday evening. No big finish here. No brass section bringing down the curtain. Just a little music to follow a friendly little chat. Good night, Americans.
You've just heard Orson Welles talking between Americans.
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles has just spoken to you as one American to another. And incidentally, do you remember when Orson mentioned the hundreds of thousands of Americans working in those oil towns and gas stations? Well, those Americans make up a great industry that's a vital part of America, the oil industry. There are about 400,000 gasoline dealers helping traffic flow along the highways, making possible business trips, visits to your friends, the stores and movies, pleasant rides in the country. That's only part of the oil industry's contribution to making the American way of life the grand thing it is. And to keep it that way, to safeguard our way of life, well, the industry's helping there, too. It's supplying fuels and lubricants for factories busy turning out materials for our defense. In addition, the oil industry is supplying all the gas and oil needs of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force. And for the vastly augmented Air Force planned in the future, Gulf and other oil companies are building enough 100-octane aviation fuel plants to take care of the increased demand. That's only a glimpse of what the oil industry, of which Gulf is a part, means today to the American people and the American way of life. For next week, we really have a show that'll put you into a great humor. The RKO hit, My Life with Caroline, starring those top favorites, William Powell and Ann Southern with George Barbier. Music by Oscar Bradley, assisted by Frank Tours. Until then, this is Roger Pryor speaking for your neighborhood good golf dealer and saying good night, everyone.
Orson Welles appeared tonight through the courtesy of Lady Esther and is currently making The Magnificent Ampersons at RKO. Don't forget our date next week when the Gulf Screen Guild Theater brings you William Powell, Ann Southern, and George Barbier in My Life with Caroline. Bud Heaston speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Orson Welles, speaking the words of Norman Corwin on the 7th of December, 1941, between Americans. And there's one more piece here for this section of the program. And this is actually, this was posted just this morning up on the Nostalgia page, NEWSTALGIA.crooksandliars.com. Fascinating. It's a talk by Henry Wallace. And here is the description to introduce this piece that is up on the page. They say that everything old is new again, and in this case, everything new is old again. Old news is the fact that this country weathers through economic disasters on a periodic basis. The remedies, like insanity, are once tried over and over again, hoping to achieve different results. And subsequently, we are routinely visited by the ghosts of disgusting familiarity. In 1949, we were in the midst of yet another recession. This one was by and large the product of a post-World War climate, a period where dramatic upheavals were taking place all over the world. The Cold War was a relatively new malady and a focus point for alarmists everywhere. Our foreign policy was a shambles, the same shambles it is today, but for mostly different reasons. Our domestic policy was busily being undermined by the legendary Do-Nothing Congress. Deja vu, you ask? And we were starting on that gradual decline that has taken us to where we are today. Former Vice President and presidential candidate for the Progressive Party, Henry A. Wallace, laid out the situation in a radio address, part of the radio series Pro and Con, on July 29, 1949. Wallace was acutely aware of what the problem was. As Secretary of Agriculture prior to his vice presidency, he oversaw many of the New Deal recovery programs take shape to help put this country back on its feet. Clearly, in those 60-plus years, not much has changed. Well, the stakes, the greed, the corruption, and the incompetence have reached new heights, but the bottom line hasn't. And that's where the insanity takes over. From July 29, 1949, this is the Honorable Henry A. Wallace.
Good evening. This is Leif Eade in Washington once more with Pro and Con. Tonight's Pro and Con is about recession, business slowdown. It was noted by President Truman in his mid-year economic report, where he spoke of a moderate decline. While retail sales and personal incomes have held up pretty well, there has been a rather pronounced drop from last year's all-time record production. The president has advanced an 11-point program, but he also noted this. The kind of government action that would be called for in a serious economic emergency would not be appropriate now. Pro and Con's guest tonight does not agree. Our guest tonight is Henry A. Wallace, progressive candidate for president last year, and the official spokesman for his party. His subject tonight is Depressions Don't Stop Themselves. And now for Henry A. Wallace, we take you to New York.
On Monday of this week, the president handed us a bill. It was a bill for the first down payment on a 20-year program of sending arms to Western Europe. It was a bill for $1.5 billion, $50 for every American family. But that's only the first year's cost. Next year it'll be more, because modern weapons of war get more expensive all the time. We shall be lucky if at the end of 20 years we have spent less than $50 billion on the North Atlantic Pact. But no bill has yet been submitted to provide jobs for the millions of unemployed. I've come here tonight to tell the American people that when we are taxed, presumably to stop Russia and communism by shipping arms to other nations, we open the door to the real aggressors against all people everywhere. Waste, depression, hatred, and finally that supreme waste, the frustration of unemployment, the rotting away of men and resources unused. There are cynical men who tell you that our arms program puts men to work. I say that any prosperity that depends on such wasteful and criminal employment is certain to end in disaster. I say it is wasteful to produce arms when men need houses and schools and roads and hospitals. I say it is criminal to drain our resources to produce goods that no one can use except for war. And it is dishonest to say that producing arms will also produce prosperity. The administration has spent countless billions for arms, but those billions have not stopped the gathering storm of an economic crisis either at home or abroad. Spending for arms has not kept unemployment from rising at home, nor stopped the crisis abroad. When President Truman asked for military aid for Greece and Turkey in March of 1947, I said that if the Truman Doctrine were continued, the United States would bleed from every pore. And every year since then, Democrats and Republicans have joined hands in taking tens of billions of dollars away from you and me on the pretext of defending us and the world from aggression. The same men in Congress who hold up their hands in horror at the idea of using government money to create peacetime employment in the United States cheerfully vote billions to create disaster abroad. The president may well go down in history as the man who propped up the world with bayonets and tanks and airplanes while factories were closing and men and women became unemployed by the millions. Like Louis, the King of France, after him the deluge. Today, there are twice as many unemployed as last year. The administration's own figures show us that unemployment is close to 5 million. Next year, there may be 10 million, while the president and his cabinet tell us there is nothing to worry about. Like Hoover in 1930, Truman preaches that a return to prosperity is just around the corner. his Secretary of Commerce and his Secretary of the Treasury sing the same lullaby song as the Republicans sang in 1930. Just have confidence in Papa and everything will come out all right. His Secretary of the Treasury writes a soothing piece for a national magazine without a single word about the millions of men and women who have no jobs and no prospect of jobs. The president fails to realize that all Western civilization is in the grip of a worldwide cataclysm. Truman would stop the storm by building a wall of armaments. But the real answer is to provide abundance for the common man in all lands. Walls of guns will only accelerate the catastrophe, not delay it. And our own fabulously efficient capitalism will, through its very efficiency, bring about its own downfall unless it provides the means to buy the goods it produces. We have proved ourselves marvelously efficient. Today we are producing three great surpluses. A surplus of goods that families cannot buy. A surplus of arms that no one wants. And a surplus of men who cannot find jobs. It is no answer to say that 1949 is not 1929. It is no answer to point to government safeguards that did not exist in 1929. That's the Maginot Line type of economic thinking. It is like placing dependence on sandbags and small reservoirs as a permanent flood control project. When a really big flood comes raging down from the mountains, the sandbags are no protection, and the little dams, when they break, make the flood only greater. The president has no program to provide jobs, because he has no understanding of what is happening at home or in the world, and he is tied to a false and disastrous foreign policy. He does not see that the key to our continued prosperity is that more people must have more money to buy the goods we produce. The big truth is that the men and women who work for wages and salaries today are getting a smaller portion of what the nation produces than they got in the war years. They need a bigger portion. It is no answer to say that savings are high. The truth is that one-third of American families have no savings, and that most of the savings are in the hands of the top 10%. The wealthy 10% can't buy all the products of our farms and factories. That is why there are 3 million fewer people working this summer than last summer. That is why farmers are making one-tenth less money. That is why business failures have doubled in less than a year. The president tells us the decline in industrial production has only been moderate. But as I look at those figures, I see that the decline in the last 7 months is as great as the decline in the first 7 months of the 1929-1930 bust. To reverse that moderate decline would require a substantial increase in wages, an enormous increase in spending by government or business. Does anyone believe that the president has a peaceful plan to increase any of these activities? The president and the Congress may give the economy another military shot in the arm, but that only means the patient will keep going for a short time and then fall flat on his face. Congress is already balking at high spending. At long last, sensible men in Congress are beginning to call for disarmament. More and more, the people see through the fallacy of spending more for arms and less for jobs and prosperity. On Monday, the president asked for $1.5 billion for more arms to Europe. His arms message was urgent. But 2 weeks ago, when he announced his domestic program, there was no urgency. Of course not. And the result is that the Brannan Farm Program has been dropped by Congress. There is no effective minimum wage increase. And there is only a token payment for public works. The president is full of pledges against aggression when there are no signs of aggression. But he is strangely silent and fails to recognize the real aggression of creeping unemployment. Nothing in the president's report to the nation 2 weeks ago gives me so much concern as his remark that the situation today does not require strong positive measures. Too little and too late can ruin us just as certainly in peace as in war. The president cannot take strong and positive measures because he is tied hand and foot by his commitment to a $22 billion spending program for the Cold War. He tells the nation that we can afford $22 billion, and now another $1.5 billion, to fight the Cold War. But we cannot spend any billions for jobs for men and women at home. On the same day, the president called for $155 million to stimulate arms production in Europe His roving ambassador in Europe said we must cut help for modernizing European agriculture. In other words, the Truman-Harriman directive is to produce Tommy guns, not tractors. We have spent over $20 billion building a wall against Eastern Europe. We now propose to man that wall with arms. But at that very moment, economic necessity begins to smash that wall. Britain, the nation which has received more American aid than any other nation, to keep her a willing partner, is now in effect calling off the Cold War. Britain is now substituting a trade agreement with Russia for the Cold War. A blunt economic need is driving all of Western Europe to conclude similar agreements with the East. Here in the United States, leadership in Congress is slowly emerging to fight the insane course of world military action which is fostered by the administration. To save the world, we must smash militarism and at the same time provide jobs. We must defeat the appropriations for the arms program as a necessary step to meeting the needs of the unemployed. We must immediately raise unemployment benefits to $35 a week for a period of 52 weeks. Congress should also stop delaying extension of veterans' benefits by passing the Veterans 5220 bill. But Americans have a right to a job, not merely relief. Therefore, I urge a bold public works program. We can double and quadruple our spending for housing. Communities badly need schools and roads and hospitals throughout the nation. We must construct and develop our river valleys. All these things mean jobs, peaceful jobs, productive jobs, jobs at decent pay that will produce goods that we can use, not arms. We're not immune from the growing world crisis, nor can we stop it by arms. If we really want to help the world in order to help ourselves, then I say we must move at once to set up a worldwide development fund through the United Nations in place of the one-sided, wasteful funds we are now spending abroad to build up arms. Several years ago, I said that a bold new approach of this sort would cost us $5 billion a year for 10 years. Since that time, we have spent far more and only brought on a world crisis. I propose, too, that we recognize with as much realism as Britain has recognized that the time has come to sit down and talk business with Russia, with Eastern Europe, and with China. The President should immediately appoint a trade mission to those countries and offer to work out trade agreements. The truth is there are 1,000 factories in America that could provide 1 million jobs if our trade with Russia and Eastern Europe were on the same basis as our trade with the rest of Europe. And if our trade with China were put on the same basis as our trade with the rest of Asia. Yes, this will cost some money. But it will be a fraction of the billions upon billions we shall lose if we do nothing now and let a shattering depression sweep over us. If the United States does not take a strong and positive step to build one prosperous world at peace, if we do not take the offensive against the creeping aggression of unemployment, there will come a time when the depression of the early 30s will seem very mild. I don't want to see my children and your children go through the heartaches of that kind of a depression. I don't want to see the world rot again in the midst of abundance. Nobody knows when the really big time of trouble will come, but every thoughtful person knows that to prevent it, we must adopt an approach which is really new, which is really bold in terms of people and not in terms of words or politics.
And now back to Lee Feed in Washington.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. Ladies and gentlemen, Pro and Con has just presented Henry A. Wallace, progressive candidate for president last year and the official spokesman for the Progressive Party, in a talk on Depressions Don't Stop Themselves. The points mentioned by Mr. Wallace, the special Veterans Unemployment Plan, 5220, has lapsed, although its extension was recommended by President Truman. The House Ways and Means Committee has a bill on changes in Social Security, but its contents have not yet been disclosed. The President has also announced a program for increased government buying in areas particularly hard hit by unemployment. But there does seem to be an agreement between the President and Congress that our economy has great reserves, that the recession will be comparatively short-lived and that no major action on the part of the government is called for at this time. And now, this is Leif Ead in Washington saying good night until next Friday evening at this same time.
Pro and Con is a public service feature presented by the National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations. Each week at this time, Pro and Con presents a prominent guest discussing subjects of topical interest. This program came from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. The preceding program was transcribed. KFI and KFI-FM, Los Angeles.
Just imagine KFI broadcasting that message today. It would make a hell of a lot more sense than Tim Conway Jr., but what can I say? From the 29th of July, 1949, former vice president and presidential candidate for the Progressive Party, Henry A. Wallace. Advice that rings true, especially today. And that largely does it for Echoes of a Century, not Echoes of a Century, for for Blacklisted Talk Radio. We'll be having, for the live feed, live stream on killerradio.org. It is now 2:05 on Friday afternoon. For the live stream, we will be having a couple of programs of Echoes of a Century dealing with the events of December the 7th of 1941 and how they were, and the following day, and how they were reported at the time. Fascinating, fascinating material. And so that's coming up. I hope that you enjoy that. And if you're listening on podcast or on MP3 at radioforall.net, that material will be in the Echoes of a Century series. Simply search for the series Echoes of a Century at radioforall.net, and you'll be able to find those episodes there. Next week, 11 a.m., hopefully I'll have the clock right so I don't break into something 10 minutes, 11 minutes ahead of time at, 10:49. But at 11 a.m. next Friday afternoon for most of you around the world, I'll be back again. I'm King David McKenzie. I appreciate your having been here, and I shall see you again then. Until then, as always, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space. I'll be seeing you later.